Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Baku, Sevilla,
Amsterdam,
Glasgow,
München,
St. Petersburg,
Bucharest,
Budapest, Copenhagen,
Roma, London.
We're back after the longest football-free period since that England-Scotland game. Euro 2020 returns with the last 16 in Amsterdam. Great Danes and a Wales side as leaky as a national stereotype. And at Wembley, Laser Blazer sees Austria beaten by Chiesa, but Italy exposed like they were managed by Roberto Mancini. Our thoughts on those matches and Sunday's games coming up. Belgium against Portugal, Big Ron v Big Rom. Will Netherlands go Dutch when they get the Czechs? And we relive this.
Sig Thorsen.
Oh, my word.
Oh.
It's the Totally Football Show at the Euros in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. Sunday, 27th of June. Thank you for making it totally. And thanks very much to Matt Davis-Adams for his excellent work helming totally through the group stages of this Euros while I was off at the Strongman. And you will never guess what happened there. But it's a closely guarded secret. With us today, Sasha Gurianov. Hello, Sasha.
Hi, James.
And also Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
Hello. For you, Tommy, the Euros is over.
I mean, I'm going to carry on watching, but yes, for my national team, it is sadly over.
Hey, Tom, join the club.
We can both grieve together, Sash.
No, I was going to say exactly the opposite. If you can't beat them, join them. I was very much enjoying supporting Denmark today, and they're a brilliant team to follow.
All right. Well, next up, Denmark will be facing the Netherlands. If the Netherlands get past the Czech Republic, a game that we'll be talking about a little bit later on with our big pal, Mikael Jongsma. Wales, of course, out. Also, Austria out after a thrilling extra time. It was something of a slow burner, that game. But we'll be talking about the Italy-Austria game at Wembley and much, much more. But let's begin, if that's all right with you, Tom, with the Wales-Denmark afternoon excitement.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
God måde til Kasper Dolberg, højrebenet Dolberg, afslutning, afskudning! Yes! Kasper Dolberg, din dejlige dreng, han er virkelig en af gudsønnerne.
The sound there of Kasper Dolberg's sumptuous curling opener Saturday at the Johan Cruyff Arena in Amsterdam, as Denmark, the first team in Euros history to reach the knockout stages after losing their opening two group games, continued their remarkable campaign with a 4-0 win over Wales. We'll get Tom's thoughts and Sasha's very, very shortly. First, on the line from Copenhagen, Eurosport TV's Nils Harald. Nils, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. And how are you, sir?
Copenhagen is busy at the moment. There's a party going on in the streets right now. Everybody's out celebrating the victory. So it's a good night in Copenhagen, yeah.
Crikey. Well, it was a bright start by Wales. But after that first Dahlberg strike, it was pretty much picture perfect from your boys. When was the last time you saw them put in a performance that note perfect?
I have to go a little while back, but I do think that in the Nations League, we played a very good game against England and obviously against Austria, who we put four goals against in the World Cup qualifiers. So, it's a good team, and it seems to be able to adjust to a game. And that's very much what we're talking about in Denmark, the ability to change the plan within the game. That's very good.
All right. Well, tell us about the key change then in this one, which swung the match.
Yeah. After 15 minutes, Kasper Juhlmann put Andreas Christensen in front of the back four. So it meant he was playing like a six, number six in the team, and he was more like a defensive midfielder, moving up from the defense. And that made a big change. That changed the shape of the team and changed the way the team attacked the game. And from there, it was getting better every time they had the ball almost.
Nils, I think a lot of people have been enjoying Denmark's progress. Sasha, I know, was rooting for you today. Denmark have become a lot of people's second team. And the narrative is so strong of the campaign that began in anguish, which is now bringing so much euphoria to the streets of Denmark. But this is beyond the kind of the team on the mission narrative. This is a remarkably gifted team, no?
Yeah, it is a gifted team, and first of all, this is a team. This is a team that Kasper Juhlmann is always emphasizing how much they stand shoulder by shoulder, how much it's a team that can change the shape, that can work together, and obviously the terrible experience in the first game has made them a bigger team, a better team. But also look at the clubs they are playing for. They're playing for FC Barcelona, they're playing for AC Milan, they're playing for Chelsea, Tottenham, and lots of Premier League clubs. And obviously, these are players who are used to performing at the big stage, and you can see that now.
Mm. Nils, I'm sure you won't make bold predictions about their potential in this tournament, but 29 years to the day this victory came after the famous title in 1992, so I bet that one felt unlikely as well. Is there a kind of groundswell of people daring to dream now?
Yeah, it's coming, isn't it? I mean, we have to look to the next game a week from now in Baku, but obviously everybody's, especially today, have been talking a lot about miracles happening in football. Today, the 26th of June, 1992, against Germany, 2-0. Obviously, now people are starting to dream. I can see in the newspapers, I can see in the articles, everybody is starting to view us as an outsider for the final. But obviously, there's a lot of way to go now.
Hi, Nils, I just got a quick question for you. This team, as we have seen in the last two games, actually, as we have seen over the last couple of years, they're very attacking, they're quite flamboyant. Is it too early to start comparing them to the Danish Dynamite team of the mid-80s? Because, I mean, 92 team was a bit more conservative, but this team is really playing free-flowing football.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the 92 team was a very, very controlled team. You know, in the final against Germany, I think they had 26 bypasses to the keeper, to Peter Schmeichel. Yeah, the 86 team is the obvious comparison. But it's also, I think they're a little bit tired of hearing that all the time. You know, that I think they want to create their own story. But if you have to compare it to a team, maybe the team in 98, remember that team that got to the quarterfinal at the World Cup with Michael Laudrup and Ebbe Sand and players like that. I think that maybe they're closer to that as far as I can see.
Mm. All right, Nils. Well, listen, you go off and enjoy the nighttime antics in Copenhagen, and we'll catch up with you in and around the clash with either Netherlands or the Czech Republic.
Yeah, I think they closed some streets in Copenhagen now because of the party going on, so I think I better have to take a look at that now.
Absolutely. Journalistic duty and that. Thank you so much for being with us, Nils.
Thank you so much.
Nils Harald there. Well, Tom, first of all, that was a phenomenal goal to open the scoring from Kasper Dahlberg.
Yeah, a fantastic goal. A goal that arrived at just the right time for Denmark and just the wrong time for Wales. And as you said to Niels, Wales started the game really brightly. First 10 minutes, Gareth Bale was picking up the ball in dangerous areas, getting a couple of shots off, and you started to wonder whether Wales were about to take control. And then Denmark make that quite subtle tactical change of moving Andreas Christensen into midfield, and that gave him the platform. And Dolberg scores a lovely opener set up by Mikael Damsgaard, who's really come to life in the last couple of matches. And then Dolberg gets his second early in the second half. And it reminded me quite a lot of the manner in which Wales went out of Euro 2016 against Portugal. We'd kind of gone all the way to the semi-final. There was all this hope. And then Portugal scored two quick goals early in the second half. And you just knew as soon as the second goal went in that it was over. And it was the same sort of feeling against Denmark. And then they get the third goal right at the end. And you're just sort of getting used to the idea that it's going to be a 3-0 defeat. And you're thinking, well, they probably just about deserve that. And then Harry Wilson gets sent off undeservedly, and that sticks in the craw a little bit. And then they get a fourth goal, Denmark, in stoppage time, and it ends up being a fairly miserable afternoon. But yeah, no real complaints about the outcome. Denmark were worthy winners, and Wales' second Euro adventure in the last 5 years comes to an end.
Mm. Some wonderful lip-reading opportunities from Joe Roden after the second goal window. And Gareth Bale, meanwhile, whose future, of course, was one of the big question marks hanging over this game. Where do we stand now with that after he walked out of the BBC interview? He was more forthcoming with S4C, I believe.
Yes. So he very abruptly and quite strangely, I thought, just declined to answer a question when it was put to him by the BBC Touchline reporter. A question about his future, which, as we know, has been the subject of great speculation the last few weeks. But then he was asked about it in an S4C interview. He sort of gave the impression that he was committed to Wales, at least in the immediate future, that he's going to be there for the resumption of the World Cup qualifiers, and that, you know, he wants to carry on playing for Wales as long as he continues playing football. And it made me wonder whether we might be about to see the first time ever that a player retires from club football to concentrate uniquely on his international career. Because as we know, he's got a year left on his contract at Real Madrid. But, you know, given the cloud beneath which he departed Madrid when he went back to Spurs on loan, it's hard to see him ever really being happy there. So, yeah, there is a big question mark about his future. And although he still seems committed to Wales, he has said that he's going to make an announcement about his future at some point in the coming days, the coming weeks. And you suspect it is going to be a bit of a bombshell because he's been teasing it for the best part of a month.
I have a wild stab in the dark. What do you think it's going to be?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he's built it up so much, perhaps unintentionally, but it just makes me think he's going to do something a bit left field. So maybe he is going to stop playing club football or something, or maybe he's going to move somewhere unexpected, or maybe he's going to try and make it as a golf pro. I don't know, but there's something about it. You feel like he is going to surprise us in some way.
Right. I'm looking forward to that. Meantime, I knew you as an avid student of the French game will have been excited for Casper Dolberg with his brace today after the travails that he's been through. This is actually a story that producer Charlie immediately reminded us of, but we reported in our first ever Euro Totally Football show way back in October 2019, the Dolberg watch affair.
Yes, yeah, I'd actually forgotten about that. So Casper Dolberg was the first relatively big-name signing that Nice made after they were bought by Ineos, the British petrochemicals firm that owns the Ineos cycling team, etc. And this takeover deal was rumbling on over the summer of 2019, and it went through about 3 days before the transfer window closed, and Dolberg was about the only player they managed to bring in. So there was a lot of focus on him right from the start. One of the first things that happens to him is that he gets this quite expensive watch stolen by a teammate who was subsequently sacked by Nice. Actually had quite a good first season, Dolberg, in a fairly middling team under Patrick Vieira. And then last season had a terrible time of it. He had coronavirus at the start of the season. He had all sorts of injury problems. He had to have his appendix removed in February, and he was out for about 4 weeks. He ended up finishing the season with only about 5 goals. And, you know, the expectation with Dolberg, you know, going back to his Ajax days, was that he would end up being, you know, Denmark's main centre forward. And actually, he didn't start the first game, perhaps even the first two games at this tournament, but, you know, back in the starting 11 today. And yeah, gave a glimpse of what he's capable of.
For me, today's match was eerily similar to what happened to Russia, because Denmark get a worldie, Denmark pounce a mistake, and then Mele delivers the coup de grace. Perhaps that, you know, it's appropriate that he's called Joachim, like cavalry riding in and riding down the opponent. And I thought overall, and also actually against Russia, Christensen was stepping up into midfield as well. So I think they took a lot from that game, and almost Hjulmand, everything he touches at the moment turns to gold, because obviously they lost Poulsen, but then Dahlberg comes in and slots in absolutely perfectly. And also I thought it was quite interesting the way that Christensen was used, that they didn't really play through him. He was there purely to break a play. I mean, I think if you look at the passing stats, absolutely nothing goes through him. So he's there to challenge, I think, either Kiefer Moore to break up stuff around Ramsey. I thought very smart and very, very cute move, because also after an hour, they move him back. They go back to the back three and they just defend, see the whole game out. So it's very, I thought, whereas against Russia, it was still a very emotional performance. This time against Wales, I think they came out to show what they can do. It was very much, we're here, we're very good at football, and we will beat you, without as much emotional background as there was with the Russia game. So they showed kind of two levels of, I think, almost emotional maturity. And also, all talk of Denmark moving away, they went to Amsterdam and they played another home game. I think it's 15,000 Danish fans there or something like that, which I thought, again, was quite important. So I'm actually curious how many of those Rolligans are going to make it to Baku for the quarterfinals, because the travel is a bit inconvenient, and that would probably be a proper neutral venue for them. So let's see how they do there.
Let's. Two questions. One, can you explain the Joachim reference? And two, are you backing them in that quarterfinal?
Joachim, it's Joachim Murat. He was the famous cavalry commander under Napoleon. And, you know, obviously, cavalry would strike in a decisive moment and, you know...
Oh, yeah, of course, sorry. Yeah, obviously. Sorry, Sasha, that should have got
strike
that.
Down the fleeing enemy. Apart from it, look, if you look at how the game is organised, and if they, for example, come up against Holland, I mean, I think tactically and they will do Holland. I think perhaps if they come up against Czech Republic, the Czechs might suffocate the game quite well. But once it gets to the semi-finals, if they do get to the semi-finals, it's anybody's game. So I'm still not sure about all the way. I think Wesley Sneijder was predicting before the tournament that Denmark could go all the way. I think that's a bit mad. But certainly they've shown, actually throughout all of this tournament, because even in the first games, they dominated. They should have been winning. And I think it's great that they had, like, you know, three games to get it right. And I think certainly the way they're on their roll at the moment, it's hard not to back them in the quarterfinals against whoever they face.
Netherlands will be facing the Czech Republic on Sunday. We'll be hearing from Mikhail very shortly on that. A last thought for now on Wales, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, obvious disappointment. I think it was unfortunate in a way that this tournament came so soon after Euro 2016, because that created such a sort of sense of expectation in a way that this team was always going to struggle to live up to. You look at that Euro 2016 team and almost every player in the starting 11 was a Premier League player. This was a much more of a ragtag team. Premier League reserves, championship players, championship reserves. I think what stands Wales in good stead is that this is quite a young squad. I think it was something like the third youngest squad at the tournament. And the next generation of Wales internationals, players like Joe Rodon, Harry Wilson, Ethan Ampadu, Dan James, have now got that major tournament experience. There are question marks over the futures of players like Gareth Bale, how much playing time Aaron Ramsey is going to get at Juventus next season. But I think globally speaking, it's been a positive experience. Qualified for only their third major tournament, got out of quite a competitive group, and, you know, managed to avoid complete disgrace. And lest any Wales fan get too despondent, a reminder that in the space of 1 week at Euro 2016, Wales won more European Championship knockout matches than England have won in the tournament's entire history.
Oof. Nicely done. Very good.
Not entirely relevant to this tournament, but, you know, always good to end on a positive note.
Indeed. Next up, off to Wembley.
The Euros are here, and we'd better make the most of them, because they only come around every five years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpa diem. If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch, and you'll get a completely free £5 bet builder on England v Germany this Tuesday. Paddy Power.
Pre-match bet builder bets only. Match 1 free bet. Win 2 plus legs. Online exclusive. Must have previously deposited. T's and C's apply. gamblerware.org.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Italy-Austria, Saturday night. Italy, managed by Belloc out of Rangers of the Lost Ark. 2-1 winners after extra time. The Azzurri had started well but couldn't convert their chances. The Austrians then had the better chances in the second half but had a goal by Arnautovic ruled out in extra time. Mancho's two substitutes made the difference, especially Federico.
Cerca il secondo palo, Chiesa, la palla buona. Chiesa la mette giù con difficoltà, poi Chiesa! 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 La Chiesa al centro del villaggio! 1-0!
Pessina also scoring, and then Italy conceding their first goal in 1,169, was it, minutes? Yes. But riding out 2-1 winners and through to the quarterfinals. They go. Me, a simple person following the football, was extremely excited by Federico Chiesa's wonderful chop and shot. But Sasha, clever folk like you saw the bigger picture. Tell us.
Well, it wasn't really clever folk. I was just sheer horror. I was like, where is Alaba? And I had to have another look. And I think it's Pessina who makes a diagonal run, takes Alaba away, and Lima doesn't realise what's going on and doesn't cover, and then he's too late. So I think it's Pessina that actually creates that goal, and of course, and he scores the other one. So for me, Matteo Pessina of Atalanta is a hero of the day, just like Mele was a hero for Denmark earlier.
All right. Although Chiesa's goal was pretty special, yeah, wasn't it?
Well taken.
Inside. Bergkamp against Argentina, 1998-esque, some people were calling it.
Yeah, there was a lot of comparisons to the Bergkamp goal, and you could see it, particularly with the second touch. I mean, he does well to keep the ball in play. I think it's a pass from Leonardo Spinazzola, and it really kind of kicks up off the turf. So he has to control it with his head, and then as I think it's Konrad Leimer comes in, the fire engine rushing to the wrong fire, little chop inside with his right instep, and then flashes it across the keeper with his left foot, and you sort of... I was going to say you felt the fight go out of Austria then, but actually they sort of stuck at it, and you know we did look like we were potentially heading to a grandstand finish. But as I think as much as Austria will have been hurt to lose in such agonising fashion, I think they gave a really good account of themselves.
I think Austrians are already, even before this game, Austrians were already heroes to their fans. I think I mentioned on one of the earlier pods that, Austria isn't really much into football anymore. It's not the 30s. It's not the Wunder team.
it's not even the 54 team, which finished third. It's been such a long time since they had any success. And no one really, especially after the pathetic defeat against Holland, no one really expected that performance they put in against Ukraine, which was just marvelous, which was proactive, which was heavy pressing, which, again, like everyone got everybody talking, got the fans excited. And that was a performance for the ages. Best in a generation. And I thought today again they put in a very different performance, but also the best in a generation. Was dogged, they stuck at it even when they went 2-0 down, and I thought that's it. I stopped making notes. I thought I'll just watch, you know, these last 15 minutes. They could have scored twice then as well. It was amazing. They could barely move, and then you could see at some point Italian legs started going as well, and they really like played absolutely beyond their abilities. I think, you know, people like Alaba carried them through. I think Zabitzer put another great shift in. And I mean, they're the big names. But I think, you know, compared to some of the other nations of sort of similar stature who absolutely bombed, Austria basically did absolutely everything they could. And again, this is a team that was coming into the tournament with very, very low expectations. We're a very, very pessimistic public. And, you know, they're going to be coming back to Austria as heroes.
Well, back to Austria they will go, while Italy continue in the competition. They are now unbeaten in 31 matches, 26 of those victories. The longest run now in their history. As I mentioned, 1,169 minutes without conceding before that late Kalajic goal. How worried, though, should Mancini be about how easily Austria shut them down in that second half particularly?
I thought, from an Italy perspective, this was actually quite a reassuring performance and result, because it's
grounded
not the Italy
out.
Way. Yeah, it's not the Italy way to go through tournaments beating teams 2-0, 3-0, not letting goals in, you know, playing this fantastic football. You know, they've got no major corruption scandals hanging over their heads. The players are all speaking to the media. Surely you need some of these factors hovering in the background if Italy are actually going to go on and win this thing. But no, I think that, you know, when we all saw how Italy just steamrolled everyone in their group, and everyone was very impressed by that. And this was Italy having to produce a slightly different sort of performance. I mean, the first half suggested that they would go on and win quite comfortably. And it reminded me a bit of their opening game against Turkey, which was 0-0 at half time, but with Italy very much on top. And within sort of 20 minutes of the second half, they'd put the game to bed. And you thought the same thing would happen here. But as it happened, Austria, you know, really sort of dug in, stepped things up a little bit, and Mancini had to turn to his bench, and that's ultimately where the breakthrough came through, with, you know, obviously Chiesa and Pessina getting the goal. So I think actually, you know, it shows they can grind down slightly more obdurate opponents than those they came up against in the group phase, and it shows that they've got depth in the squad that enables them to make changes and still be decisive, you know, at the end of close matches.
Well, that's certainly true about the depth, but I wonder, against a team with better finishes, perhaps against Austria, whether they might have paid a bigger price than they did today. What was it that Austria did to knock them out of their stride after, as you say, such a swashbuckling first half?
Well, I mean, they're a very well organised, very hard working team, and the Austria first 11 is full of very good players. You know, they almost all play for leading German clubs. They've got a really good range of ages. You know, mid-late 20s, early 30s, a few youngsters, lots of energy. You've got Grilich and Leimer and Schlager in midfield, sort of clogging things up. They've got a threat on the counter-attack with Sabitzer and Arnautovic. You've got the experience of Hinteregger and Dragovic at the back. I mean, they're a relatively complete team. And I think it was just, you know, it was hard work. It was preventing Italy from sort of getting into the kind of passing triangles that have become their modus operandi under Mancini. And yeah, in the end, Mancini had to throw on some fresh legs, because otherwise it didn't look like he was gonna find a way of getting past them.
Indeed, their confidence looked shook. Sasha?
I would give a special shout out to Grilich, because, I mean, him coming into the central midfield in the last two games, I thought he made a huge difference and gave them that platform and stability which could either protect, as they did today, or could be used to be very aggressive, as they did against Ukraine. So I think he comes out of this tournament with his reputation greatly enhanced.
Also, the goal that was ruled out for offside, one of the narrowest VAR calls that we've seen in the tournament. And at that stage, 65 minutes, Austria were very much on top at that stage. It didn't feel as if the goal was undeserved. And had it stood, might have been a very different outcome.
It might indeed. Arnautovic there, but Italy aren't out of it, he said, segueing neatly, and we'll be facing Belgium or Portugal in the last eight. And then, because they're in the tricky side of the draw, they'll have somebody like France or Spain or Croatia in a semi-final if they get past Belgium or Portugal, which, to be fair, is anything but a given. That Belgium-Portugal game, of course, is coming up later on Sunday, and we'll be talking about Sunday's matches next.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Still to come on this exciting Totally at the Euros show, we've got some classic on this day fun. But now, let's talk about Sunday's round of 16 drama. Netherlands are taking on the Czech Republic. Belgium are taking on Portugal. And that, I put it to you, is the biggest game of the tournament so far. Exclamation mark, question mark.
Yes, I would agree.
Okay, it's the holders against the number one ranked side in the world. That's Belgium. Have they lived up to their billing so far?
Belgium or Portugal?
Well, let's say Belgium first of all.
Yeah, I think we've seen glimpses of Belgium at their best. I mean, they put three goals past Russia without really having to try. But I think the moment when everyone sort of really sat up and took notice was that second half of the second game against Denmark, when they go a goal behind, was that right? They were a goal down.
Not playing
well. And then De Bruyne comes on, and Axel Witsel comes on, and Eden Hazard comes on, and De Bruyne just starts completely running the show. And in the space of 45 minutes, they score the two goals that give them victory against what we know to be a very good Denmark team. And then you thought, okay, this is why people get excited about Belgium. So, yeah, I think out of all the favourites, they're one of the few teams who have shown us a glimpse, a tantalising glimpse of their absolute best football. And I think it puts them in a good position against a Portugal team who have flattered to deceive quite a lot, albeit one who seemed to rediscover a bit of solidity in their final group game, that 2-2 draw against France.
Well, I think this is the interesting thing. The two teams come into this under very different conditions. Effectively, Belgium have barely played, whereas Portugal had to really play out of the skins to reach this stage. And curiously, I thought, well, reassuringly for the game, Fernando Santos, the Portugal manager, was saying that this game is going to be like a final. The main thing is to win rather than to play beautiful football. So here we go, 0-0 penalties, perhaps. But I think maybe in this situation, it would be interesting to see whether, is it Renato Sanchez renaissance continues, whether Bernardo Silva actually finally offers something. It's hard to see Bruno Fernandes return to that midfield. But at the same time, Cristiano Ronaldo against that aging back line, is he going to be completely starved of service or is he actually going to run them ragged?
Just to pick up on Sasha's point about freshness, Belgium have had two more days to prepare for this game than Portugal have had. And all those key players have now picked up minutes and going into the tournament, we were saying, well, you know, how are they going to fare without De Bruyne in their opening game? And Axel Witsel hasn't played a game since January. And, you know, and Eden Hazard, we know, has barely kicked a ball all season. And those players have all got decent minutes under their belt, so they should be a little bit fresher. I wonder how Portugal are going to approach this game in terms of their midfield configuration. Because what we saw in that France game was they put an extra man in central midfield, Renato Sanches, and it gave them a lot more sort of industry, a lot more energy. And if you look at Belgium's options in the middle of the pitch, in their last group game against Finland, they played a midfield two of De Bruyne and Witsel, two excellent players, two key players to Belgium. But if they're going up against a three-man Portugal midfield that has the energy of Renato Sanches in it, I wonder whether that might be something they could struggle with. Or we could see De Bruyne perhaps playing slightly further forward, perhaps in the false nine role, and they bring in Yuri Tielemans perhaps to sort of beef things up a little bit. But that, I feel like that could be an area where Portugal could try and sort of harry Belgium out of their stride.
And it would also be interesting to see like the role that Diogo Jota plays here, whether he will be able to connect that sort of quite defensive shield of central midfield for Portugal and Ronaldo. So I think perhaps Jota in this game could be the key player.
Well, yeah, or it could be that fellow Romelu Lukaku, who's been absolutely outstanding so far for Belgium. And you're right to question how the likes of Alderweireld, see what I did there, and Vertonghen are going to fare against the Portuguese. But how's the Portuguese backline going to do against the various Hazard brothers and Lukaku? I don't know, but we will be finding out come Sunday evening. Roberto Martinez, of course, has now the most tournament wins of any Belgian manager ever. Extraordinary statistics.
And he'll be on home soil in Spain, albeit, unfortunately, it's on that dreadful pitch in Seville,
yeah,
which hopefully won't be too big a factor.
Do you think that actually might affect it, that they won't be able to just run effectively or pass the ball or nothing?
It's a very good point.
It's such a bad pitch. It leaps out with you. Every group game that was played there, after about 5 minutes, sometimes you turn on the TV, you forget where a game's being played, and you're sort of waiting for a little clue or for the commentator to mention it. But every time I watched a group game played in Seville, within about 2 minutes, you'd seen someone try and control a pass, and it had bounced away off his knee. And it was, yes, we're at this weird little ground in Seville again.
Also, it's going to be really hot there, they say. Expected to be around 30 degrees at kickoff, even at 9 p.m. Spanish time. Biggest game yet, and the best possible backdrop for it. Fantastic. That's 8 o'clock UK time, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to that. Before that, a little antipasto, we've got a Netherlands taking on the Czech Republic, the chic team, to borrow a Guardiolaism. Netherlands, perhaps the biggest surprise of the Euro so far. 2 weeks ago, when I departed, Netherlands had responded to getting their first tournament in 7 years by appointing a comedy manager. I was shocked to see on my return that in a kind of reverse Charlton Heston, they haven't blown it all up, but instead have romped through the group and were the highest scorers in the group stage. Let's ask Mikael Jongsma what's going on.
Well, obviously, Frank de Boer is now considered the best manager in the world, but no, on a more serious note, it's still, I mean, the Dutch are very critical. Even if Dutch teams win, it's still very much about playing style, about seeing weaknesses. This could be more attractive. We could do better. Why is Martin Drogen in the side? Why is Wout Weghorst in the side? All that kind of stuff. So it is a continuous debate. I don't think the Dutch would ever be happy with anything less than swashbuckling 6-0 victories over every possible competition. But to be fair, like the Dutch have been quite a bit more positive, and the three victories were all quite convincing. It's clear that apart from the starting 11, that seems to be, well, solid enough, and with the lack of any real favorite at this point, perhaps Italy is one, but the Dutch are very much in the mix behind them. It feels like, especially with the way the draw has gone, the Netherlands actually have a good shot at reaching the semi-finals, which would be remarkable given all of the unrest that there was before the tournament.
We're speaking before Wales take on Denmark, but if you do get through your clash with the Czech Republic, who are up next, that's, you'll be facing the winner of that game, either Wales or Denmark, and then potentially England in a semi-final. So Frank de Boer, Euro winner, are you ready for that?
I don't think anyone is ready for that. But it would be a really nice redemption for him, especially because in the Euros folklore, like in Dutch history, is very much associated with missing penalties, which he did right. In the Euro 2000 semi-final game against Italy, when the Dutch were probably the favorites and had a really strong team. So for him, it probably means a bit more even than it would for anyone else. It is very interesting because, as I said before the tournament, like the one thing that you're slightly concerned by is the wing play. Denzel Dumfries all of a sudden seems to be the new Cafu, which is fantastic. Patrick van Aanholt has had a decent tournament, but it's mainly that spine that holds the team together, because they have looked solid, especially in the last two games with Matthijs de Ligt coming back in. Stefan de Vrij is having a good tournament as well. Frenkie de Jong is doing Frenkie de Jong things, which is always good fun to watch. And even Martin de Roon has kind of justified his inclusion by not playing against North Macedonia, because the Dutch did look a bit more vulnerable in midfield. And I think the main man this tournament so far is probably Gini Wijnaldum, who looks nothing like the economical, quite safe midfielder that he usually was for Liverpool, but is very much a flair player in this side. And with the Czechs coming up, that they are a more serious competition or opposition than the Dutch have faced so far. But it's going to be very interesting how the Netherlands hold up. I would say that they are overwhelming favorites, especially with the attacking options that they have, and the Czechs haven't been that impressive apart from Patrick Schick doing incredible things. And it's going to be really interesting in general how the Dutch are going to play against this Czech team, because in terms of team selection, Daniel Malen, who was really impressive against North Macedonia, has definitely given Frank de Boer a bit of a headache who to partner with Memphis up front.
You mentioned Euro 2000. That's part of this extraordinary statistic that since winning the Euros in 1988, Netherlands have only ever won two more knockout games in all the Euro competitions since, and the Czechs have played their part in that. So you're quietly confident, whilst at the same time name-checking Patrick Schick, that Netherlands are going to be okay this time, though.
Yeah, absolutely. The Ruud van Nistelrooy, the assistant manager, actually said, like, the team spirit in this team is like, it's not something that I really recognize from my own time with the Dutch national team. They all seem to get along very well. They're very, very hungry as well. As you mentioned, it's been 7 years since the Dutch played in a national tournament. By that time, Denzel Dumfries actually was still an amateur footballer, and he's 25 now, so that's quite remarkable too. So they all really want to shine on an international tournament. Memphis Depay and Gini Wijnaldum are two that have actually had that experience. Stefan de Vrij is another one. But for a lot of these players, it's a very new opportunity, and especially with the delay that you had due to the pandemic, that hunger has actually even grown quite a bit. And it seems like a very, very, very good group of people. And they look well equipped to get past the Czechs. And I would say that, the route to at least the semi-final is actually wide open.
Wow, Mikel, I can't believe it. So you're actually confident that this isn't just the fruit of being in an easy group with Ukraine, Austria and North Macedonia, but this Netherlands side is for real?
Yeah, but that's partly due to the other countries not impressing that much either. I think the fun thing about this Euro so far is that every team seems to have a flaw, and if it's a striker that can hardly stay on side or get a goal, like in the case of Spain, or with England, it's basically the same, to be fair. You have France looking, well, not very impressive. The Germans needing last-minute goals to even qualify against Hungary. And even the Belgians, who have been looking decent from time to time, were not that convincing in their group either, despite the three wins. So I'm not saying the Dutch are that brilliant, but it's definitely a case of just a lot of teams looking to contend. And with the draw going their way, I think everybody expects either Germany, England, or the Netherlands to push through on this end of the draw. I would say that the Dutch would have a chance against those teams as well. So it's the pessimism ahead of the tournament, where people were actually saying, well, we'll see if we'll even win a game, has definitely been replaced by that typical Dutch arrogance that I'm guilty of at this point as well. But maybe I'll get all the abuse on Sunday evening by people saying, ha ha, you arrogant Dutchies. There you go, 5-0 against the Czechs.
Mikael Jongsma, who's in a brilliant form. The Czechs, very much the Netherlands bogey side, not only preventing the Oranje for qualifying for Euro 2016, the last edition, but also that famous come-from-behind victory at Euro 2004. What do you think of the Czechs' chances? They came into this as one of the third-place outfits to make it out of the group stage. What do you think of their chances against the high-flying Dutch?
I mean, from what we've seen from the Czechs so far, it's hard to see them go for another 3-2, given how miserly they've been. They've barely allowed any shots. And they barely had any shots themselves. I mean, they settled for a 1-1 with Croatia. They were already through when they were playing England. And, you know, I think they were pretty happy just to go through at that stage. So it's hard. Again, it is one of those teams that's hard to understand where exactly they stand. Of course, Schick is in decent form. And Socek, with one of the partners in the 4-2-3-1, has been fairly solid. But again, it feels a bit like, not quite like Belgium, but again, a team that hasn't really had to show everything for all three games.
Right. They had 9 shots on target in their 3 group stage games, but 7 of those 9 came in their opening match against Scotland. Schick, who you mentioned there, is the scorer of all their goals so far. 3 of them, and 1 was from the halfway line, of course. Very nice it was, too.
I wonder whether one potential avenue to success for the Czech Republic could be on set pieces, because the Netherlands have looked a little bit shaky on defensive set pieces in the tournament so far. Conceded a goal from a free kick in their first game against Ukraine. And Czechs have got some big lads. Tomáš Souček, who we know all about from his exploits with West Ham last season, very dangerous at set pieces. Patrick Schick as well, who scored a header against Scotland. So that might be one area where the Czechs can cause the Netherlands some problems.
Netherlands also have looked quite shaky at the back against Ukraine. Also, Macedonia had that opener that was a shade offside, and then they hit the post. Plus, they're no longer going to be playing in Amsterdam. Anyway, we'll see what happens come Sunday afternoon. And of course, Totally will be back with you Monday morning to report on that and the Belgium-Portugal game. Very, very shortly, we'll get a little bit of an update on the situation in St. Petersburg, where we got the first of the quarterfinals taking place on Friday. At least that's the plan. And also, we'll have a very special on this day in Euro's history, particularly if you are a Scottish or Welsh fan. But first, though, let's get to mods from Paddy Power. It's over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. I'm on the line with Jason Murphy from Paddy Power. Jason, let's look ahead to tomorrow's games then in the last 16. It's going to be exciting. Holland versus Czech Republic to start with. Could there be 4 or more goals in this one?
Could be. 4 or more goals, it's 11-5. That's saying essentially it happens 31% of the time. And if you think it'll happen more often than that, then you could certainly have a look at it as an angle. But do be aware that we do see the goal rates drop off in knockout stages. The drama, the tension goes up. People don't go chasing more goals when they have a lead to hold on to. And what I would also advise is the Dutch came out with what was a weak group. If you look at their formation, say, against Ukraine, it suited them because Ukraine were 4-3-3. The Dutch had the natural width with Van Aanholt, Dumfries, and it played into their hands, whereas this Czech Republic side are going to go with a 4-2-3-1. And that defensive box that you're going to see with Holis and Souček is going to eat up that space. That space that Wijnaldum been getting a lot of opportunities from. So for me, for this game, given the knockout nature of it, I'd actually have a look at under 2.5 goals at about 10-11. It's probably a slightly better angle.
Well, over to Belgium versus Portugal then. Looks fabulous on paper. I think it's going to be absolutely terrible and cagey and nil-nil-tastic. Can you give us, please, some overalls in this one?
Yeah, so Belgium to win in 90 minutes. We have an enhanced price there of 6-4. We have Portugal 11-5. But I really like that Belgium price. Like you say, on paper, I can understand what the price is that. But if you get down to the nitty-gritty of the tactics and the players that are going to execute the tactics, this Belgium 3-4-3 against this Portugal 4-3-3, Belgium hold all the aces, because Germany went with that 3-4-3 and we've seen the damage that it did to Portugal. If you continue with the likes of that formation with a Thorgan Hazard, Thomas Munier on the wings, you have Lukaku who will stay central and pin the centre-backs, that's going to leave a lot of space for Eden Hazard, Kevin De Bruyne to do what to do best. The only thing with that suits Portugal potentially is the counter-attacks, and we've seen that being executed devastatingly for that opening goal against Germany. But the midfield three that Portugal have, it's probably Renato Sanchez, Danilo, if he's fitting well. It's not a Xavi, Iniesta or Busquets. It's not going to play to that advantage. So for me, Belgium at 6-4 is the best bet. But if you want a bit of a fun, interesting angle, Ronaldo to score a penalty. It's essentially Portugal scored a penalty. It's 5-1 in the sports book. Ronaldo's success rate from penalties is running about 84%. He's a little bit above average, but look, we all know he's more than above average. And it's just another interesting angle, but definitely Belgium at 6-4 to win this game, to me, is one of the best bets for this knockout last 16 games.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power. Find a bookie who loves you right back as much as Gareth loves right backs. Place a 4+-fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Sign up for a subscription with The Athletic. It's just £1 a month for your first 6 months. Head to theathletic.com/totally. You get all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, including The England Show, the latest episode of which features David Priest and is all about penalties. You can also read George Culkin's piece with the likes of Alan Shearer and Paul Gascoigne on what it's like to be a spot kick taker for the Three Lions in a major tournament. Crikey, all of that and much more for £1 a month. Sasha, quarterfinals start on Friday with the game scheduled in St. Petersburg. But the situation there, in health terms, is looking pretty dramatic. What's the latest?
Yeah, it's looking pretty grim. And I think at one stage, a few months ago, it would be easy to think that Russia basically abolished COVID the way that everyone was going about it. And in recent weeks, there's been a surge. There's definitely a surge in Moscow. There is also one in St. Petersburg. I think the latest, they had over 2,500 cases. And of course, the problem is, it's not like in the UK where everyone's getting vaccinated. In Russia, there's a lot of skepticism around it. So to the extent that they're now basically companies or government entities are forcing employees to vaccinate. And to the extent, I think some restaurants in some cities would introduce the whole thing about if you're not vaccinated, you can't come in. So they're really forcing the population to take the vaccine. So if you take example of St. Petersburg and actually tangible results of going to St. Petersburg. So I think the Finns have reported 120 cases amongst fans returning from the Euros, which isn't cool. And one maybe saving grace, if, for example, France and Spain make it to St. Petersburg, is that there won't be many travelling fans. Actually, it struck me in 2012 how little French travelling support was. And I think for Spain, I'm not sure it's going to be that much bigger. So perhaps the saving grace is there won't be too many fans coming in from abroad. However, even this week, they have this annual celebration in St. Petersburg of, you know, kids finishing school. And there's like these videos of these squares full of people all over each other in the current situation, which I find absolutely astonishing. So I think, you know, in terms of the quarterfinal, I think they'll muddle through. But the COVID situation is currently getting worse and worse.
We're hearing that Croatia's Ivan Perisic has just tested positive for COVID, which is worrying news for him, of course. Also for the team ahead of their clash on Monday with Spain. And yeah, we'll see how that story develops in the days to come. Best wishes to him anyway. Next up, let's have a little bit of On This Day in Euros history. And it's a special one today. I refer to the 27th of June, 2016. Yeah, national holiday in Scotland, Wales, and many other right-thinking areas of the world. England, who'd gone a goal up against Iceland in their most recent last 16 game at the Euros, thanks to a Wayne Rooney penalty, saw things take a spectacular turn for the worse. Ragnar Sigurdsson immediately equalising for Iceland. Then, as Steve McLaren bigged up his side's chances of responding well,
keep getting pressure on the Iceland back four. The only thing that they have got is the big boy up front, Sigurdsson, who really, Sigþórsson.
Oh, my word.
Oh.
A Joe Hart clanger allowed Sigþórsson to make it 2-1. And the rest, well, it's history, isn't it?
I remember it well. I was there at the Allianz Riviera. I was on the England beat at Euro 2016. And had seen Wales qualify for the quarterfinals 2 days previously by beating Northern Ireland 1-0 in Paris. So was already in quite a chipper mood, and then sat there in the stadium on a balmy evening in Nice, surrounded by the great and the good of the England press back, and watched England slump to their biggest humiliation since the 1950 World Cup.
Yeah, it wasn't just that they went behind. They had 70 minutes to sort it out, but instead you had treats like that, a Kane free kick, which might have injured you or someone near you. I'm not sure, Tom. So wild did it fly. Hodgson, meanwhile, morphing into a meme on the sideline. You quite possibly were there then post-game when he resigned. And this is kind of, some people might feel this is topical, a senior figure in the England setup resigning without ever mentioning the kind of big issue. In this case, the fact that they just lost to Iceland for Hodgson. And then he had that second press conference the next day because they told him he ought to go back. And he said, I don't know what I'm doing here. I thought my statement last night was sufficient. It was surreal.
It was, yeah. They announced his resignation in a statement after the game. And then I don't think he came in to do his press conference. I might be wrong.
Really?
But then the following day, back in Chantilly, so everyone has had to, you know, leave Nice and track all the way back up to the England camp. He gets led into this press conference and the little press marquee that had been set up there. And he sat down and the first thing he said was, I don't know why I'm here. I said what I had to say in my statement yesterday. I don't think I've got anything to add. And he was sat there with, what was he called, Martin Glenn, who was in charge of the FA at the time. And one of the most surreal press conferences I've ever sat through, because he didn't want to be there. He didn't have any answers to any questions. And yeah, it was quite a bleak experience.
Mm. The headline writers enjoyed it. Ice Wallies, that was one. Poundland 1, Iceland 2. Cod Help Us, and you know, etc. And so on. Anyway, England will have their first last 16 match at the Euros since that fateful day on Tuesday, when they'll take on Germany, as you're probably aware. Sasha, did that game produce as much merriment round your way as it did with Tom?
Well, round my way was coming back on the Eurostar via Lille. And I think we watched the first half in Lille as we had to disembark, and it was 1-1. And then we emerged out of the tunnel on the other side with England being 2-1 down and heading out of the tournament. I think with Russia at the time, I think they were more concerned about Russia being absolutely dreadful, and they were still going through the aftermath of Russia going out in the group stages. So it wasn't really merriment. It was a bit like, wow, they've done that. Good. I think the reaction was more like, well done Iceland, rather than LOL at England.
Right. So, yeah. Well, indeed.
And if you recall, there was a bit of a PR issue for the Wales squad, because a video of them raucously celebrating Iceland's victory was leaked from within the camp. Basically, all the Wales squad all sat around to watch the game, and then there was fairly riotous celebration involving what seemed to be pretty much the entire squad when Iceland won. And the way they explained it was that it wasn't an anti-England thing. They were rooting for the underdogs, you know, plucky old Iceland.
Right. Well, so you know, which is closed. Understandable. Plus, you know, if you don't want people to root against nations, don't have national football. I mean, that's what it's all
well,
about.
Well, quite.
Anyway, there you go on that important point. I think that's where we come to the end of our coverage of Saturday's action. As I mentioned, there's another one of these on the way Monday morning, when we'll be back with Michael Cox and Duncan Alexander. They'll be giving us their thoughts on Sunday's games and looking ahead at the Monday stuff. For now, it's many, many thanks to Tom and Sasha and producer Charlie, who's been up all night literally with this listener, and you for hopefully enjoying it. We'll see you soon. For now, from Totally at the Euros, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at The Totally Show on Twitter, and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.